Morning TNC family, on this first Sunday in April, 7 days before Easter, I want to consider with you now three scenes in Jesus' life during the last week of his life, three scenes that tell one story. Three scenes, one story, and the setup for the scenes comes from Mark chapter 14 and verses 1 and 2. It's a Wednesday, just 2 days before Jesus will be crucified. The text says, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot. In other words, we want to kill him, we want him dead, but the crowd is a deterrent. Because the crowd loves to be around Jesus. They love him, and he loves them. And TNC, let's just stop right here, right at the beginning, and consider for a moment, before we even start, do people love to be around you? Because following Jesus, being his disciple, wanting to become like him, one primary way you can know if you are becoming like Jesus is not, do I share Jesus' eschatology, theology, or ecclesiology? Not, do I believe the right things? And not, am I witnessing and testifying about the evils of that group, or that sin, or that lifestyle choice? And not, do I vote the right way, or hang out with the right people? Instead, the essential question of whether or not you're becoming like Jesus is, do people love to be around you? And I don't only mean, does your family or your friends like to be around you? I mean, do people not like you like to be around you? Jesus summarized it this way, I think, very well, Luke chapter 6. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. Rather, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Because TNC, what separated the love of Jesus from the way other religious leaders loved was, Jesus loved everyone, and they knew it. In a first century world that marginalized women, Jesus valued them, treated them as equals. In a first century culture that treated children as property, Jesus treats them like they're a window into the joy and the trust of God's kingdom itself. In a first century world that marginalized anyone, not of the right ethnicity, Jesus says, all are welcome and valued in the kingdom of God. Samaritans, Romans, Assyrians, the sick, the poor in spirit, those who mourn, those who hunger and thirst for truth, the doubters, those who are persecuted, they all discover that they're welcome and loved, and they're inspired and challenged and comforted by God's love. And it's a big problem for those who want to kill Jesus. The problem is everybody loves to be around him. So, do people love to be around you? And I know we humans are far from perfect, so it won't be that folks like to be around us all the time, and sometimes our love will be a tough love to them, which will sometimes not be welcomed by folks. But the central point, you understand, I hope, is that if our lives are centered around becoming more and more filled with God's Spirit and transformed into God's likeness, and if love is the central quality of a Jesus follower, which it is, then, be honest, do people love to be around you? And by the way, almost every situation would be improved with love. And so if you're worried about any aspect of our culture today, political, social, environmental, relational, then know that the best approach you can bring to improving all of these things starts with how you love. love will improve everything. I mean, it's not the same thing as, but it's not dissimilar either to how almost any food is improved by ketchup. Ketchup with hot dogs, ketchup with potato chips, ketchup with grilled cheese, ketchup with eggs, ketchup with onion rings, french fries, tater tots, hash browns, roasted potatoes, baked potatoes, pickles, hamburgers, cheeseburgers, chicken nuggets, soft pretzels, broccoli, and even with tortilla chips if you're out of salsa. Almost every food is improved with ketchup, and in a similar way, almost every situation will be improved with love. It's like if you take all the ingredients of any moment of your life, the stress, time, fatigue, hope, expectations, worries, deadlines, take all the ingredients of any moment and then add love to it, and it will get better. To paraphrase Anne Lamott, love is always the question and love is always the answer. How will we move to overcome and recover from this setback, this tragedy, this loss? Love. How can this family or town make a comeback? Love. What's the next right action? Love. And what's awesome about love is it is available in unlimited quantities. Unlike most things, like if I have marbles inside of a jar and I take one of the marbles out and I pass it out, I now have one less marble to distribute. And this is the way it is with most things. There's a limit. For example, time or money or energy, they have limits, but love has no limit. The more you give, actually, the more you have. And when we live in love, then we live in God, for God is love. But one other thing, here's the other thing about love, it's a currency that may get you killed. Because there are powers in the universe that fear love, that fear equality, that fear mercy and humility, and they're going to look for a way to power up themselves by diminishing you. Which is why the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him, but not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot. Unless, of course, we can learn where he is apart from the crowd, arrest him apart from the crowd, and execute him before the crowd knows what's happening. Stealth is the last chance they have. Now, there are almost 200,000 people in and around the city of Jerusalem during the Passover festival, and so finding him away from the crowds will be impossible unless there is a traitor, a betrayer within Jesus' own inner circle, someone to lead the authorities to him when the crowd is not around. And if you skip to verse 10, you find one, they find one. Quote, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus. And they were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So Judas watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over. And now we've arrived at our first scene of the day. Today is three scenes, one story, and scene one is framed by that word, then. That's the first word of the text I just read. Then Judas Iscariot went to betray Jesus. Then. So, what happened after which Judas went to betray Jesus? What finally led Judas to betray Jesus? Answer, a scene of love. Verse 3, well, Jesus was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper. A woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on Jesus' head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor. And they rebuked her harshly. Leave her alone, Jesus said. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing for me. She did what she could, She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare me for burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priest to betray Jesus to them, because in this moment, in this scene, it sinks in for Judas. Jesus is not interested in setting up an earthly kingdom of power, but rather, Jesus is interested in an earth infused with "first shall be last, greatest among you shall be servant of all." And Judas sees that this kind of selfless living is just going to lead to Jesus' persecution and death and burial, which is why the word then, Judas decides to betray Jesus, because Judas is not interested in love. He's interested in power. And that's scene one shows us that love is the way of sacrifice and selflessness and inclusion and generosity, which is often the way of the cross. That's scene one for today. Now scene two, which takes place just one day before Jesus will be crucified. It's Thursday in the upper room where Jesus gathers for one last meal with his disciples, the Passover meal, where we learn, verse 4, that as the evening meal was being served, Jesus got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. Then he poured water into a bowl and began to wash his disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel he was wrapped in. And I wonder now what you're thinking, listening. I wonder what you're imagining, because it's important that you don't imagine an insulated, drywalled, air-conditioned room with soft carpet under their feet and a 60-watt soft yellow LED light bulb overhead with soft Christian worship music playing on a Bluetooth player in the background. Rather, imagine that the floors are hardened and dusty, the windows are glassless, open to the outside air and noise. There's likely a small fire nearby, and so the room is filled with smoke and soot, and they can hear people running around in the streets, and there's not a clean white tablecloth with a fresh smell of linen neatly hanging from the table, upon which sits a dozen or so flickering vanilla-scented candles. And in the corner, there's not a drawer with a set of clean towels dried with fabric softener and folded into thirds. Further, when you imagine this scene, when you imagine Jesus washing their feet, you have to understand that foot washing in that day was mostly done by women, not men, by the poor, not the rich, by slaves, not the owners, by the defeated, not the victor, by the follower, not the leader. Psalm chapter 60 actually gives a good picture for how foot washing was seen. King David, in verse 8, declares that God will subdue his enemies, and that, quote, "Moab, my enemy, will be my wash basin, and upon Edom, I will toss my sandal." This is the picture that we see over and over and over, not just in the Jewish culture, but in the ancient Greco-Roman world too, where those who receive the foot washing are almost always the social superiors to those who are rendering the service. Yet here, Jesus, preparing to eat with his 12 disciples, takes off his outer robes, gets a bowl, pours some water in it, ties a towel around his waist, and begins to wash 24 separate feet. Peter's, James's, John's, Thomas's, Matthew's, Judas's, everyone's. And after he has untied the now wet and very dirty towel from around his waist, he puts his robe back on, returns to the table, looks around at his friends, and asks, verse 12, "Do you understand what I have done for you? Do you know what I've just done?" And you can read the whole story later, but you'll see that the disciples don't really understand. Not yet, anyway. Now, they will soon. They will after the cross. But in the moment, the disciples were like, yeah, you washed our feet. But Jesus responds, well, yes, but it's way more than that. It's a window into the heart of God, which is washing their feet was not something Jesus did removed from being God. He washed their feet precisely because he had come from God. But what's even more than that, TNC, Jesus says, yes, I washed your feet, but don't you understand what I've really done is I've shown you what to do. Verse 13, as I have done this to you, you should do it for one another. Okay, Jesus, you want me to wash other people's feet? No, it's way deeper. I want you to do love, Jesus says. Verse 34, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you. So you ought to love one another. Verse 35, by this everyone will know you're my disciples, if you love one another. See, in washing his disciples' feet, the disciples came to understand that the defining characteristic of a Jesus follower is not your biology, genealogy, eschatology, anthropology, or ecclesiology. It's your love. It's like this. If I showed up at your home and interviewed the rest of your family, first, it would be fun. Secondly, I wonder if love would be what you are renowned for in your home. Or if I showed up at your work and I passed out a survey to all your work colleagues about you, would they check the box for love as being your primary personality trait? And if a group of friends looked at the way you spend your money, every bill, every swipe, every deposit, would love be the one inevitable word they use to describe the management of your resources? And it's even more than that, because Jesus says, yes, I washed your feet, but don't you understand that what I've really done is I've shown you where you can find me after I'm gone. Now hang with me on this, because this point is beautiful, and I owe a great debt to American Episcopal priest, professor, author, and theologian Barbara Brown Taylor, because this is her point. In her book titled Always a Guest, she writes about the foot washing, and she says this, quote, through the foot washing, I believe Jesus was showing them how they could get really, really close to him whenever they missed him too much, or lost their way, or wondered what they should do next. And now you just have to think about that one for a moment. Because I have a friend who took up baseball card collecting after his father died. Why? Because his dad collected cards, and he feels connected with his dad now whenever he does this hobby. And I know a woman who, after her mother passed away, she took up tending to flower gardens, which was her mother's favorite hobby. And when she's in the garden to this day, weeding and watering and picking, she feels connected to her mother. And in the same way, Jesus says, after I'm gone, yes, serve others and love others so that they are enriched, but also, as an act of communion with the divine, with the divine dimensions of the world, because when you serve others, you'll be closest to me. And that's scene two for today, another scene of love, which brings us to scene three. And now Jesus is hanging on a cross. And in a most tender scene, we're told in John chapter 19 and verse 25 that, quote, near the cross of Jesus stood his mother, Mary. And as you imagine this scene now, I wonder if you wonder how near Mary stood to her son. And I wonder if Jesus tried to keep his mom away so she would not have to see that the body that she brought into the world, the body that she nursed, the body that she laid in a manger and fed and bathed and clothed and worried over and tended to while sick, she now has to watch nailed to a cross. And even then, in this moment, the scene is a scene of Jesus loving. The text says, quote, when Jesus saw his mother and also saw his friend, the disciple John, standing by her, Jesus said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to John, behold your mother. Verse 27 says, and from that hour, John took Mary into his own home. Which is to say that no matter what else we gain from this scene, we can't miss this, that even as Jesus hung on the cross, dying in pain, Jesus was still concerned for his mother and sought to ensure that his mom would be taken care of after he was gone. And so he asked John to take care of his mother, and he asked his mother to accept John's protection and care. And actually, according to some traditions, not every tradition, but some, Mary lived out the rest of her days with John in the town of Ephesus on the west coast of what is now Turkey. And you can even visit today what some believe was the home that John built for Mary and the place she lived until the end of her life. And so this is scene three, and it's another scene of love. This time, love of a son for his mother, but even more than that, because it offers us this idea that relationships in the church transcend DNA relationships. It reminds me of Mark chapter 3, where Jesus says, whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. Also reminds me of the words of the Apostle Paul, who envisioned the church as being the family of God. Do you see it? John now opens his home and devotes his time and resources to care for Mary. And in doing so, both John and Mary, they model for us this call of Christ to see those in need as our mother or brother or son or daughter. And so these are three amazing scenes in the last week of Jesus' life, in the week before his death on a cross. Scene one, love. Scene two, love. Scene three, love. And I hope that no matter what else you think or do this week, in preparation for Easter Sunday, I hope you'll love, because it's love that we celebrate this week and next weekend. And it's in loving that we participate in the essential meaning of Easter weekend. For God so loved the world, for God so loved the world that he gave, and he calls us to do the same. Let's pray. God, we are genuinely excited to celebrate Easter joy and Easter hope this week, and to celebrate it together as a church family. And we are beyond grateful that you have defeated death, and that we can live in confident anticipation for the day when death will be no more, because your love has defeated death. And we are so grateful too that you have given us an example to follow, an example of grace and love that absolutely refuses anxiety and refuses clinging to status, and instead is empowered by your compassion and your presence and your peace. God, may we see and experience and know this peace in the days ahead. Now, TNC, may the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Amen.